Acatra Foundation presents the Acatra Dialogue, an exploration of the world's greatest thinkers and ideas. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Acatra AI. Welcome to the Acatra Dialogue. Today, we're diving deep into a truly monumental figure and the book that captures her life. Ruth Bader Ginsburg, A Life by Jane Sharon DeHart.
It's a fantastic book. And Ginsburg, well, her name just resonates, doesn't it? Quiet power. Huge change.
Absolutely. And what DeHart really brings out, I think, is that she wasn't just, you know, the pop culture icon, the notorious RBG late in life.
No, not at all. She was the quiet architect. That's the key.
Mm-hmm.
She systematically took apart the legal foundations of gender discrimination, but from inside the system.
A strategist.
Yeah.
Patient, incredibly resilient.
Exactly. A long game revolutionary working within the rules to fundamentally change them.
So our mission today is to unpack that. We want to pull out the key insights from DeHart's work for you, chart her journey, understand that strategic brilliance, and maybe find some lessons for our own lives. Okay, let's get into it.
Sounds good.
Let's start at the beginning, as DeHart does. Flatbush, Brooklyn, and the influence of her mother, Celia Bader. How critical was she?
Oh, immensely critical. You really can't understand Ruth without understanding Celia. Celia herself was brilliant. Graduated high school at 15.
Wow.
Yeah, but she couldn't go to college. The family resources went to her brother instead.
A story you heard a lot back then, Sam.
Very common. And that thwarted ambition became this powerful force that she poured into Ruth. She gave her two core lessons that stuck with her for life.
Which were?
First, be a lady. But not in the sense of being demure or subservient.
Right. What did it mean to her?
It meant self-control, poise, dignity, especially when facing insults or slights. Don't let anger consume you.
Okay. And the second?
Be independent. Have your own means to support yourself, to stand on your own two feet. Don't rely on anyone else, essentially.
So composure and self-reliance, that's a powerful combination.
It really is. It forged this unique temperament in Ruth, calm on the outside, but absolutely steely underneath.
But then tragedy strikes right at a pivotal moment.
Yeah, it's heartbreaking. Celia was diagnosed with cancer while Ruth was in high school, and she passed away literally the day before Ruth's graduation.
Oh, terrible timing.
Ruth had to miss her own graduation. And DeHart argues, very convincingly, I think, that this loss crystallized Ruth's purpose. It became almost a sacred duty.
To live the life her mother couldn't.
Exactly. To achieve the intellectual life Celia was denied. Every award, every legal win. In a way, it was all for Celia.
That's quite a burden, but also a powerful motivator, I imagine. So she carries this forward to Cornell.
She does. Channels all that grief and determination into her studies. Graduates first in her class, naturally.
Naturally. And that's where she meets Marty Ginsburg.
Yes, Martin Ginsburg.
Yeah.
And their partnership, as DeHart describes it, was just, well, incredibly modern for the time. Truly egalitarian.
He wasn't intimidated by her intellect.
Not one bit. He celebrated it. He was her biggest advocate, her cheerleader, right from the start. It's a really important part of her story, that support system.
Then comes Harvard Law, 1956. What was that like?
Well, picture this. She's one of just 9 women in a class of over 500 men.
9 out of 500, that's stark.
It really is. And DeHart recounts that infamous dinner, the one where the dean literally asked each woman student to justify why she was taking up a seat that could have gone to a man.
Unbelievable. Did you say how Ginsburg responded?
With that characteristic poise, that be a lady composure her mother taught her, quiet determination. But it was a clear message from the institution, wasn't it? You don't belong here.
And on top of that hostile environment, she was juggling so much personally.
It's almost unbelievable when you lay it all out. She's got her own incredibly demanding Harvard Law studies. She has a young daughter, Jane, to care for. And then Marty gets diagnosed with a really aggressive form of testicular cancer.
Oh, my goodness.
So she's attending her classes, his classes, taking notes for both of them, typing his papers, nursing him back to health.
While keeping up her own grades.
Not just keeping up, excelling. Making law review. Staying at the top of her class. It's just an astonishing display of discipline, resilience, force of will.
It really foreshadows the kind of determination she'd show later, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Overcoming these huge personal obstacles with intellect and sheer grit.
So after all that, stellar record at Harvard, then she transfers to Columbia when Marty gets a job in New York.
And ties for first in her class there, too.
Right. So top of her class at 2 Ivy League law schools. Surely the job offers came pouring in.
You would think so. But no, that's the brutal reality DeHart lays out. Prestigious law firms just wouldn't hire her.
Explicitly because she was a woman.
Explicitly.
Yeah.
Woman, mother, and also Jewish, which was another barrier at some firms then. Even Supreme Court Justice Felix Frankfurter, despite glowing recommendations from Harvard's dean.
Yeah.
He famously said he just wasn't ready to hire a woman for a clerkship.
Wow. After everything she'd proven.
Exactly. And, you know, these rejections, they were galling, obviously, but they didn't deter her. If anything,
they fueled her.
They fueled her. It was firsthand, undeniable proof of the systemic discrimination she knew existed. It wasn't theoretical anymore. It gave her the evidence she needed for her life's work.
So being shut out of that traditional path forces her hand in a way.
It does. She pivots to academia. First Rutgers Law, then Columbia, where she eventually becomes the first woman to get tenure there.
And that academic perch gives her the space to develop her legal strategy.
Precisely. It allows her to dive deep into this pretty nascent field at the time, women's rights law. And that leads directly to 1971, co-founding the ACLU Women's Rights Project.
ACLU being the American Civil Liberties Union.
Right. And this is where she transforms from scholar to really the architect of a legal revolution.
Okay, so let's talk about that strategy. DeHart calls it incrementalist, like a master bricklayer. What does that mean?
It's fascinating, really. Her genius was understanding her audience, an almost entirely male judiciary, steeped in tradition. She couldn't just walk in and demand radical change.
They wouldn't have accepted it.
Exactly. So her strategy was to educate them slowly, meticulously, case by case, brick by brick.
And a key part of that was using male plaintiffs, right? That seems counterintuitive.
It does, but it was brilliant. By choosing cases where men were harmed by gender stereotypes like Steven Weisenfeld, a widower denied survivor benefits that a widow would have automatically received.
In Weinberger v. Weisenfeld.
Right. She showed that these weren't just women's issues. This was about rigid stereotypes hurting everyone. It demonstrated that gender discrimination violated the 14th Amendment's equal protection clause.
The guarantee of equal protection under the law.
Precisely. She framed it as a universal principle, not a special interest plea.
And it worked. She argued 6 cases before the Supreme Court in the 70s.
And won 5. It was remarkable. Reed v. Reed in 71, where she wrote the main brief that was the absolute breakthrough. First time the Supreme Court applied equal protection to strike down a law discriminating based on sex.
But she wasn't just winning cases. She was building the entire legal framework, laying down precedents.
That's the master bricklayer part. She wasn't aiming for one big, flashy win that might get overturned later. She was building a solid foundation, precedent by precedent, designed for enduring change. It was methodical, strategic, and ultimately incredibly effective.
Okay, so this success leads to her appointment to the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals in 1980.
A very prestigious court, often seen as a stepping stone to the Supreme Court.
And then 1993, President Clinton nominates her, and we have to mention Marty again here.
Oh, absolutely. DeHart details his relentless behind-the-scenes campaign for her nomination. He was calling senators, writing letters, really pulling out all the stops. Their partnership was just central to her entire career trajectory.
And she becomes only the second woman on the Supreme Court. How does DeHart characterize her time there?
Sort of in two phases. Initially, she was more of a consensus builder, working methodically within the court. Her majority opinion in United States v. Virginia, the VMI case.
Right, striking down the Virginia Military Institute's male-only admissions.
Exactly. That's a prime example of her early work. But then, as the court's composition shifted, more conservative.
She became known more for her dissents.
She became the leading liberal voice in dissent. Her dissent in Shelby County v. Holder, the Voting Rights Act case in 2013, was particularly powerful.
That's where the famous line comes from, about throwing away your umbrella in a rainstorm.
That's the one. Comparing the majority gutting the Voting Rights Act to throwing away your umbrella in a rainstorm because you are not getting wet. It was sharp, memorable, and really captured the essence of her disagreement.
And around this time, she unexpectedly becomes this cultural phenomena, the notorious RBG.
Yeah, it's quite something, isn't it? A young law student creates a Tumblr, and suddenly this octogenarian justice becomes an icon for a new generation, a symbol of resistance, resilience.
Giving her ideas and her dissents a reach far beyond court opinions.
Absolutely. And DeHart also covers her incredible battles with cancer throughout her later years. Multiple bouts, serious ones. Yet she faced them with that same quiet determination.
Rarely missing a day on the bench, apparently.
Almost never. Scheduling chemo on Fridays to recover over the weekend and be back Monday. Just incredible resilience.
Now, the book also addresses the controversy around her decision not to retire during the Obama administration. How does DeHart handle that?
Carefully. It acknowledges the strategic arguments made by some liberals, the desire to ensure a Democratic president appointed her successor.
Right, to maintain that ideological balance.
Exactly. But it frames Ginsburg's decision primarily through her own lens. Her fierce independence, her belief in her ability to continue contributing effectively, and her fundamental view that justices shouldn't time retirements based on politics.
So presenting it as rooted in her character and judicial philosophy, rather than taking a side on whether it was the right strategic move.
Precisely. It presents the different perspectives without endorsing one, highlighting the complexity of the decision and its roots in her long-held principles.
Okay, so stepping back, how would you synthesize her core philosophy based on DeHart's account? What really drove her?
I think it boils down to a few key things. First, this deep belief in a living constitution. The idea that principles like liberty and equality need to evolve to include people the founders originally overlooked.
Like women.
Exactly. And second, that strategy of incrementalism. Change happens step by step through patient, logical argument and building precedent. No sudden revolutions, but deep, lasting shifts built on a solid foundation.
And her motivations. What was pushing her forward through all those decades?
DeHart really emphasizes three intertwined threads. First, that deeply personal mission to honor her mother, Celia, and fulfill that unrealized potential that never left her.
Okay.
Second, her own direct experiences with discrimination. The Harvard dinner, the job rejections, they weren't abstract injustices. They were personal affronts that fueled her fight.
Made it real.
Absolutely. And third, despite those experiences, she had this profound faith in the American legal system itself. Not that it was perfect, but that it could be perfected. That it was a powerful tool for achieving progress if wielded correctly.
And her approach to dealing with setbacks, with adversity, it always came back to be a lady.
It really did. Yeah. Not lashing out in anger, but channeling that energy into working harder, being more prepared, using overwhelming logic and intellectual force. The chemo scheduling is a perfect example, facing a huge physical challenge with discipline and strategic planning.
So resilience wasn't just passive endurance for her.
Not at all. It was active. It was strategic. Treating obstacles, whether sexism or cancer, like complex legal problems to be analyzed, prepared for, and overcome with meticulous effort.
Looking back across that long life, DeHart must identify some key moments, some real turning points that shaped who she became. What stands out?
Yes, definitely. I think you can pinpoint three really critical ones. The first has to be the death of her mother, Celia, in 1950.
Right before graduation.
Yes. That transformed Celia's lessons about independence from advice into, like we said, a sacred mandate. It gave her this relentless drive, this profound sense of purpose that powered everything that followed. It's the bedrock.
Okay, what's the second?
Being denied those clerkships and law firm jobs in 1960. Graduating top of her class, only to be told no, simply because she was a woman.
The Frankfurter rejection.
Exactly. That wasn't just a career detour. It was a defining experience of the systemic barriers she faced. It pushed her towards academia, yes, but more importantly, it provided the concrete injustice, the raw material that became her life's work. Those no's basically handed her her mission.
And the third turning point?
I'd say arguing Frontera v. Richardson before the Supreme Court in 1973. This was a huge moment.
The case about benefits for spouses of service women.
That's right. And during the argument, she quoted Sarah Grimke, the 19th century feminist and abolitionist, saying, "I ask no favor for my sex. All I ask of our brethren is that they take their feet off our necks."
Powerful words.
Incredibly powerful. And while the court didn't go quite as far as she wanted in terms of the legal standard, the 8-1 victory was massive. It cemented her reputation as the leading voice for women's rights in the country. It was her arrival on the national stage, articulating her vision.
So, reflecting on all this, what are the broader lessons? What does her life teach us beyond the law?
Well, one huge thing is the power of that partnership with Marty. It really was a kind of superpower for her.
An egalitarian marriage way ahead of its time.
Completely. Built on mutual respect, mutual support. He championed her career as much as his own. It's a model that shows how a supportive partnership can unlock potential in both people. That's pretty universal, I think.
And then there's that other relationship people always talk about, her friendship with Justice Antonin Scalia.
Yes. Fierce ideological opposites on the bench, but deep personal friends. They loved opera together, respected each other's intellect immensely.
What does that tell us, especially today?
It raises such an important point, doesn't it? Their friendship was this very public demonstration of civility. You can disagree profoundly on fundamental issues, fiercely even, without demonizing the other person, without personal animosity.
Disagreeing without being disagreeable.
Exactly. In our polarized times, that feels like an incredibly important, almost radical lesson, maintaining humanity across deep divides.
So we've taken quite a journey through Ruth Bader Ginsburg's life, guided by DeHart's book, a woman whose quiet persistence and strategic mind really did change the landscape of American law and society.
Absolutely. A monumental life.
If we had to distill it down, what are the key takeaways you think listeners should hold on to?
Okay, three big ones come to mind for me. First, an emotional insight. It's the profound lifelong impact of her mother, Celia. Those two lessons, be a lady with dignity and be independent with self-reliance, shaped everything. Every success felt like a tribute to Celia's lost potential. It shows how deep personal motivations can fuel public action.
Right. That connection is vital. What's the intellectual takeaway?
An intellectual insight. That has to be her master bricklayer strategy at the ACLU. The sheer genius of that incremental approach. Using logic, precedent, even male plaintiffs, to patiently educate the judiciary and build lasting systemic change rather than just aiming for quick, possibly fragile victories. It's a masterclass in strategic influence.
Build it stone by stone so it lasts. Makes sense. And finally, a universal lesson.
A universal insight. I think it's that lesson from her friendship with Scalia. The importance of disagreeing without being disagreeable. Their ability to maintain deep respect and affection despite profound ideological differences is such a powerful model for navigating disagreements in any part of life, especially today. Civility is a strength.
Powerful takeaways indeed. Her life really underscores that significant change isn't usually a lightning strike, is it? It's the long, persistent effort.
Exactly. Slow, steady, strategic pressure.
So maybe something for all of us to consider, inspired by RBG, fight for the things you care about, absolutely, but maybe think about how you fight doing it in a way that might actually persuade others that leads them to join you.
Well said. That captures her approach perfectly.
Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Join us next time for a new episode featuring another world-renowned individual, a new book, and a new idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.